Hello, this is Dave with the News Gazette for Sunday, January 25th, 2026. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. The article headlined, Flying High, is from the village of Rantoul. Reinvigorated, former Chanute Air Force Base, expected to keep thriving and growing in 2026. This is by Luke Taylor, Rantoul. A new year means new goals and projects on tap for the former Chanute Air Force Base. For the first time since it closed in 1993, all structures on the base are leased or loaned and operational, said Village Administrator Scott Eisenhower. He said the village has been able to attract various businesses through shared visions and passion. That sounds cliche, but honestly, in every case, it was both sides looking past what it was and focusing more on what it could be. The old base plays host to a mix of businesses, from PVC pipe manufacturer Maverick Pipe to Buzzard Pipe Organ Builders, which sells an entirely different type of pipe. The open hangar now hosts motocross events as B-52 Hangar MX, and nearby land became a western town for relatively safe shootouts with Salt Fork Paintball. These were all people who, once we had the opportunity to sit with them and understand their vision, pair it with properties and green space, which has sat dormant for years, turn them into vibrant environments. Not just putting people to work in ways no one imagined 10 years ago, but truly transforming the community, Eisenhower said. And the fun part is, we are just getting started. These trailblazers have now created a path, opening the door to others who want to be a part of the excitement, who see beyond the past and recognize future opportunities, and who, through their developments, want to be a part of the renaissance of this historical space. Eisenhower said, this year, Chanute will see Buzzard open, Maverick expand, former barracks be demolished, Building 96 acquired and renovated by a private entity, and continued growth by Flyover Film Studios. The village of Rantoul is also buying vacant and dilapidated structures on the former base with plans to work with potential developers on rehabilitating them. Eisenhower sees potential in capitalizing on renewed local interest in the aviation industry and said the village is hosting conversations with aviation manufacturers, component producers, and advanced technological production, research, and development companies. He also sees potential in further expansion from Flyover and the film industry in general, as the studio already uses multiple buildings on the base. Flyover president Jen Shelby said the studio found a home at Chanute after using the site to film and finding it to be convenient, alongside finding the village easy to work with. It's the fact that it's a small community and all the people in charge, from the mayor to the village administrator on down, make themselves accessible to people, Shelby said. It was easy to go in and talk to them and to sort of think out loud with them and make it all work. Flyover has shooting space for just about anything, from commercials to music videos to feature-length films. It got an extra PR boost this week when Governor J.B. Pritzker stopped by to tout the film industry's impact on the region. Champaign County is at the forefront of our state's expanding entertainment industry, one that continues to spur innovation, creativity, and positive economic impacts, Pritzker said during his visit. Because of trailblazers like Flyover Film Studios, our state is a premier destination for film production. We welcome writers, producers, cast and crew, and anyone with a story to share on screen to bring their films to life in Illinois. Shelby said they've loved being part of the revitalization of the old air base. I don't like to see small communities that just don't ever come back, she said. To me, Rantoul is a great success story. In the future, she said, the studio plans to continue working with the village and across central Illinois, hopefully drawing in newcomers to the industry as well. We need to build up the whole industry of movie making, Shelby said. That means growing our film crews and having them all be local. We will have ongoing work for years to come. Continuing inside the front page, we have Top of the Morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rossow. Jessica Lynch agrees it should be chilly for next month's polar plunge in Mahomet, just not as cold as it is today. My dream forecast is a maybe 32 or 34 degrees with a little bit of snow, she said. The negative temperatures, we can leave that behind. Lynch and more than 10 fellow servers at Champaign's Texas Roadhouse are to be commended for their all-out approach to the February 21 fundraiser for Special Olympics Illinois. For a first-year team, the number of plungers and their goal of raising $5,000 is outstanding. Just a great group of people to work with, Lynch said. They would have helped out no matter what the cause was. Lynch raced into Lake of the Woods with Urbana's Arctic Tigers, the Yankees of polar plunging, who have raised $80,000 since 2014, the last 2 years. The 27-year-old Urbana High grad and current Parkland College student jumped at the chance to form her own team. Enthusiastic coworkers made filling the roster surprisingly easy. Once I got a few of them signed up, it snowballed from there, she said. Everyone's excited. To donate or register for Mahomet's Polar Plunge, which started in 2000 and is the oldest in the state, visit plungeillinois.com. And in history, area history, in 1976, University of Illinois students stand to lose about $160,000 in financial aid if the Illinois State Scholarship Commission, ISSC, decides to make a 10% cut in its monetary awards this semester. According to Larry Macheka, director of student financial aids, about 5,500 students receive approximately $3.2 million in ISSC awards. In 2011, Champaign County ended its fiscal year in much better shape than many other state and local governments. Because of mid-year budget cuts and frugal spending by county department heads, the county's general corporate fund balance was greater at the end of the last fiscal year than it was a year earlier. County Administrator Deb Busey told the county board last week. The county ended the fiscal year November 30, 2010, with a general corporate fund balance of about $2.86 million, an improvement from $1.8 million a year earlier, Busey said. In international history, today's highlight, on January 24, 1848, James W. Marshall found a gold nugget at Sutter's Mill in Northern California, a discovery that sparked the California Gold Rush. On this date in 1945, Associated Press war correspondent Joseph Morton was among a group of captives executed by German soldiers at the Mauthausen-Gusen concentration camp in Austria. In 1965, Winston Churchill died in London at age 90. And in 1984, Apple Computer began selling its first Macintosh model, which boasted a built-in 9-inch monochrome display, a clock rate of 8 megahertz, and 128K of RAM. Continuing with our communities, from Danville Area Community College, we have an article titled, Campus Putting End to Remote Work by Staff. President thinks too many credit hours are going to online instruction. This article is by Jennifer Bailey, Danville. Making sure as many employees as possible are on the Danville Area Community College campus and not working from home is a priority, according to DAC President Randy Fletcher. As the Board of Trustees updates its policies and campus procedures, Fletcher requested that it bring consistency and clarity to the college's working hours. In response, board members approved setting a new policy regarding normal 8-hour workdays and 40-hour weeks. All administrators and classified support staff are expected to be physically present to fulfill their job responsibilities. Remote work or working from home is not permitted to meet these hours. The policy is to ensure remote work or working from home is no longer permitted, that we expect the 40 hours to be covered in person in our offices, Fletcher said. One variable he said he constantly looks at are credit hours attributed to online and hybrid instruction. Right now, he said, 75% of credit hours involve online instruction. Around the area. As an institution, I don't believe that we can sustain that, Fletcher said. We are not an online institution, and we cannot present ourselves as that. The student traffic needs to see that we are here, we're attentive, and we're ready to serve. College officials will be looking at the schedule for the remainder of the academic year. As president, I just feel that it's necessary that we are present in our offices because student traffic is so very important, he said. It shows that we're engaged with them and that then really flows into more students coming to campus to be part of this college experience. He said the college is continuing to invest in the student union, classrooms, labs, shop floors, and nursing, and other areas that should be a hands-on experience. He said there is a place for online general education, but it shouldn't replace faculty-student interaction. The Board of Trustees, with Chair Greg Wolf and member Dylan Hahn absent, also approved changes to its policy for standard of conduct and email. Discussions occurred on policies for artificial intelligence and course instruction, with votes expected next month. Fletcher said, regarding the new course instruction policy, we have to bring that under control. He said there's inconsistency and problems of administrative staff being allowed to teach beyond their administrative contracts. Under the change, all instruction duties must be completed outside of normal work hours. In other business, the board approved a $32,800 space utilization study for DAC's main campus by DeMonica Kemper Architects and heard an update on the DAC Foundation. The board also approved the retirements of Athletic Director Tim Bunton and Jonah Bolton, an accounts payable specialist in the business office. In a financial update, DAC officials talked about being in a tighten-the-belt phase, noting the voluntary separation program for employees and that salaries and benefits account for 75% of the budget. Continuing in our communities, under CU development, titled Keeping Up Appearances, a century-old campus town apartment building with national landmark status set for major restoration. This article is by Jana Wiersema, Champaign. A campus town apartment building with 100 years of history is slated for major renovations this year, with developers taking steps to ensure the local landmark's classic look is preserved, even as some of its utilities and amenities are brought up to date. The Georgian, located at 1005 South 6th Street, is owned by the Youngerman family and managed by the University Group. The exterior, because it is a historic designation, it has to stay the same, and the new windows have to be made to look like the original windows in there, said Andy Hudson with the University Group. We're trying to save as much of the original woodworking as possible, and we've had to work with local, state, and federal historic governing bodies, and they've all approved our plans. He said that in addition to exterior work, the roughly $3 million project also will include replacing electrical systems and plumbing, adding washers, dryers, and dishwashers to units, removing the boiler, and outfitting all apartments with their own heating and cooling units. Some of the internal work, such as removing cabinets, appliances, and furniture, has already begun, Hudson said. The company hopes to have its renovation permit by the end of the month, or early February. It being an older building, we're not quite sure on when we're going to be able to get the project complete, he said. We have not started leasing the units yet, but once we get through our demolition of the interior, we'll determine when we'll be able to have these units back online. But definitely, I would say by spring of 27, to be safe. He added that the interior finishes will be as close to the original building as possible. The building currently holds 28 one-bedroom apartments, and a storage area in the basement will be converted into an additional unit, Hudson said. The units, which were occupied until August of last year, rent at about $1,200 to $2,000 per month. According to a report by Eric Van Buskirk, a senior planner with the City of Champaign, the Georgian was built in 1925 and was influenced by a campus plan that incorporated Georgian Revival architecture into new academic buildings at the University of Illinois. The apartments were developed by Roger Little, who was serving in the Illinois General Assembly at the time. The Georgian is located in the middle of campus, near facilities such as the U of I, Ice Arena, the University, YMCA, the Armory Building, and the main library. It's about a 5-minute walk east from the apartment building to the main quad. The building was designated as a local historic landmark in February of 2005 and was added to the National Register about 9 months later. And continuing with Kathy's mailbag. Among the many questions asked of multimedia reporter Kathy Reiser, why don't the cities of Champaign and Urbana own the ambulances that serve Champaign-Urbana? The reader prefaced his question by saying, I've lived in CU for 27 years. Where I grew up, ambulance service was provided by the municipality. It still seems odd to me that in this area, ambulances are not city-owned, and now Carl Arrow is the sole provider of 911 ambulance service. The idea of consolidating some city services and even the cities themselves has come up from time to time over the past 150 years. Aside from the reasons why that never happened, the history of the ambulance business in CU involves a couple of other long and interesting stories. Here we go, local history buffs. Since at least the early 1960s, ambulance service in CU has been provided mostly by local businesses and nonprofit organizations. Except for a relatively brief period when Burnham City Hospital started and ran its own ambulance service to compete with one that had recently been acquired by Carle Foundation Hospital. More on that in a few paragraphs. For now, let's look at how ambulance service was provided here 60-some-odd years ago. Ken Rominger started Aero Ambulance Service in 1963 to compete with Foltz Ambulance Service, at that time the sole ambulance-only provider in Champaign-Urbana. I'm old enough to remember when funeral homes often provided ambulance service for small towns and even for some larger communities. If a local undertaker's business had just, say, one vehicle that happened to be a hearse, well, let's just say that a person suffering from a life-threatening emergency could get a ride to the hospital and then to the funeral parlor in the very same vehicle on the very same day. At that time, just about anybody who owned a vehicle that would accommodate a person in a supine position could operate in ambulance service. The vehicle always had a driver, of course, but it may not have had an attendant with or without first aid skills, looking after the patient in the back of the vehicle. That sounds woefully inadequate today, but there was nothing unusual or shady about the arrangement at the time. It was just the way things were done in the early 1960s. There were no federal, state, or local requirements for ambulance staffing, training standards for ambulance personnel, or mandates for onboard equipment. No hurry to fix system. The Federal Highway Safety Act of 1966 signaled the start of a new era for emergency services and mobile medical care, but it took years for some of the new guidelines to be adopted locally. Mary Butzow, who served as trauma nurse coordinator at Burnham Hospital in the 1980s, told me recently that before 1970, there was almost no radio communication between ambulances and hospitals in this area. If a vehicle was bringing a patient to Burnham, for example, there was no one to call by a two-way radio in the 1960s, she said. At that time, downstate ERs were mostly staffed by the hospital's house nursing supervisor and maybe one other nurse. The weekly TV drama Emergency first aired in 1972 and brought a much greater awareness of what skilled, well-equipped mobile emergency care could look like, at least in a big city like Los Angeles. It would be a while before mobile emergency care in CU caught up to Johnny and Roy's TV heroics. It seemed CU's public officials were in no hurry to fix a system they didn't think was broken, according to newspaper articles from as late as 1987. The Champaign City Council voted multiple times not to regulate local ambulances, to let the market decide whether ambulance workers should be EMTs, etc. So it's probably not a stretch to say council members didn't want anything to do with owning a city-run ambulance service. Champaign elected officials and staff may have had their hands full looking after Burnham City Hospital. The city had assumed ownership of the Julia F. Burnham Hospital in 1924. When a 1954 addition was completed, Burnham's 179 beds made it the fourth largest hospital in downstate Illinois. The city of Champaign found itself subsidizing the public hospital at times, even though patients came from throughout the county. Arrow was the only emergency ambulance service left on Champaign's police call list by the summer of 1970, as the city's other two providers were not on board with a new city mandate that no request for emergency ambulance service within the city limits shall be refused as long as one or more ambulances are available, regardless of whether the request comes from the police department. Calls for regulation. Another stipulation for inclusion on the police call list was that an ambulance company had to respond to emergency calls from every part of town and regardless of the patient's ability to personally pay the bill. Aero Ambulance, which Ed Perino had purchased in 1969, accepted the city's terms, but the two other firms operating CU ultimately did not. A May 1971 incident reported in the Urbana Courier shined a light on disparities in ambulance service from one Champaign neighborhood to the next. Staff at the Church of the Living God's Bradley Street Daycare Center summoned an ambulance, apparently by a telephone operator, for a five-year-old black boy who was complaining of a stomach ache, fell asleep, and lost consciousness. After about 20 minutes, the Reverend Mary Mullen called the telephone operator again. This time, the operator gave her the number of the ambulance service, and she placed the call herself. She said she was told, yes, they had an ambulance on the way, and we should just be patient. About 15 minutes, Mullen placed another call, this time to Aero, and they came out right away. A police car came too, and the officer told us they had been called by the other ambulance company and told they were getting crank calls from our address. That boy was asleep for most of an hour, Mullen said, and when we finally did get him to the hospital, he stayed 2 weeks with a stomach infection, according to the Courier article. Aero soon became the only ambulance provider in CU. In a newspaper article from 1976, Perino said CU was large enough to support only one high-quality, well-equipped ambulance service. As the number of ambulance calls averaged to about 10 per day, non-emergency transfers made up most of the ambulance company's business at that time. News Gazette reporter Don DiBlasio wrote in 1978 that the state of Illinois required ambulances to have emergency lights and a siren, but there still were no state standards as to number of personnel on a call, the training of ambulance personnel, the type of size of vehicle used, or medical equipment on board the ambulance. Federal guidelines at the time recommended at least 60 inches of headroom inside an ambulance to allow for movement of personnel, and because vertical space is essential for the gravity flow of intravenous fluids. CPR also requires room in which treating personnel can move, said the article. Yet, some smaller ambulance services in the area focused on non-emergency transfers and continued to operate completely legally, with just an ambulance slash hearse and a driver. Danville, Decatur, and several other Illinois cities had established their own requirements for ambulances, but Champaign and Urbana had not. The January 8, 1978 News Gazette article said Perino had been asking the city of Champaign to establish an ordinance with minimum standards for about 7 years, not to keep out competition, but because we want the riffraff out of the business, he said. Arrow's small fleet more than met any requirements that might be passed at the local level. In addition to funeral homes, CU saw several ambulance-only operators come and go over the years, including Smith's, James Rahmaker's A1, Emergency Health Care Incorporated, and Urbana Satellite Ambulance Service based in Homer. In the mid-1970s, Rantoul Police Department operated its own municipal ambulance service. 1987 News Gazette article about the Champaign City Council's rejection of ambulance regulation said, an ordinance mandating standards for ambulance service also was defeated in Champaign in 1981 and has remained dormant since it was passed in Urbana the same year, because both cities had to approve it to take effect. On April 28, 1988, the Champaign Council adopted an ordinance regulating ambulance services and establishing a city license requirement. Today, Carl Health's Arrow Ambulance Service is the only one responding to 911 emergency calls in CU and surrounding communities. The next question for Kathy was, are ice skating and ice fishing allowed on Kaufman Lake if the ice is thick enough? I seem to remember they were when I was a kid. Answer is no, they are not. Champaign Park District Executive Director Sarah Sandquist said, ice skating, ice fishing, and swimming are prohibited on Kaufman Lake. Same thing over at Urbana's Crystal Lake Park, according to Park District spokesperson Mark Schultz. Ice skating and other on-ice activity is prohibited at Crystal Lake. The lake receives stormwater runoff from a 160-acre watershed that extends well beyond the boundaries of Crystal Lake Park. With that comes influxes of warmer water and various ice melt chlorides from our streets and parking lots, which lower the freezing point of the water and result in variable ice thickness that is not safe for skating. I hadn't thought about that, but it makes sense. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Sunday, January 25th, 2026. Please stay tuned.